From the Michigan Public Radio Network, this is Michigan Calling, an hour with Senator Debbie Stabenow. I'm Rick Pluta. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be taking your calls, emails, Facebook messages, and tweets with your questions for Senator Stabenow. We'll talk about manufacturing, jobs, education, and whatever else is on your mind. Debbie Stabenow chairs the Senate Agriculture Committee. She has served two terms in the Senate and is seeking a third term this year. She faces Republican challenger Pete Hoekstra on the November ballot. We're waiting to hear from you. The phone number is 866-255-2762. Message us on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling, or email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. Your calls and questions for Senator Stabenow in just a few minutes. But first, the news. Welcome to our special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm Rick Pluta, and I am the Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio. This is an election year edition of Michigan Calling. We are going to spend this hour talking to Senator Debbie Stabenow about issues that matter to Michigan voters. And we know they matter because the questions come straight from you. In this first segment, we are talking about jobs and the economy. What else? The phone number to join us is 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. You can message us on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling, or email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Rick. It's good to be with you.
It's nice to be with you. Let's go right to our first question,
sure.
And it is from a student right here where we are in Ann Arbor.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Rubenstein, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois, but voting in Michigan.
Hi, Stephanie.
And I was wondering if you guys feel like you can make impactful change in the next 4 years in terms of the economy.
Stephanie, we absolutely have to, and we've begun that. You know, the exciting thing for us in Michigan, after being hit harder, deeper, longer than any place else in the country, you know, we've really been hit so hard in Michigan because of decisions, because of hard work, because of sacrifice, because of innovation. Michigan entrepreneurs, we're beginning to come back. I don't think we have an economy unless we make things and grow things. And the good news is that's what we do in Michigan. We make things and grow things. So I've been in the middle of, you know, co-chairing the Bipartisan Manufacturing Caucus, been in the middle of the debate on how we move forward on new clean energy technologies. I'm on the Energy Committee, Finance Committee. And we're now number one in the country in clean energy technologies, new ideas, new patents. Number one in new patents. So the ideas are coming from Michigan. We have, of course, as we all know, saved with the sacrifice of everyone in Michigan, the auto industry is turning around, and we're seeing advanced manufacturing, new opportunities in wind and solar and advanced batteries and so on. The other thing I would say is that I chair the Agriculture Committee, and I'm very excited about new opportunities, not only for production agriculture, which is so important to us. You know, we have more diversity of crops than any state but California, and we're actually almost one out of four jobs in Michigan is in agriculture, the food industry. So this is a big deal, too. What I am excited about is an initiative that I've put together called Grow It Here, Make It Here, because the jobs will be here if we're growing it here and making it here. And it's bringing together, for instance, the auto industry that is using agricultural products, byproducts now, to replace petroleum in their cars. So if you drive a Ford vehicle, if you have a Chevy Volt, you're sitting on soy foam in the seats from soybeans instead of petroleum. So there's a whole range of things we're doing, new advanced biofuels, opportunities for us, but it all comes down to one thing, and that is we got to out-educate and out-innovate the competition. And so that's the challenge for us.
You know, and we're going to talk about education in a little while, but can we talk for a little bit about one of the big news stories this week, which was the bankruptcy of A123,
sure,
which got a $250 million federal grant, and it's in the process. It's in Chapter 11. It's being broken up and sold. Is it still a good idea for our economic policy, our jobs policy, to include the government making a bet
on where jobs will or should come from?
We together have to make a bet on the future in innovation. And every other country in the world is trying to outcompete us, trying to win on the new clean energy front. In fact, China
even if some of those bets fail.
Absolutely, because here's the situation. We have success stories all across Michigan, Rick. I can take you from West Michigan, where Energetics is making wind turbine blades, or Johnson Controls, who, by the way, the hopeful news is they are at least purchasing part of a 123 batteries, and we want to keep all that technology here. But we have a whole cluster on the west side of the state. We have Merrill Technologies in Saginaw doing wind turbine generators. We have Venn Towers down in Monroe doing the big base of the wind turbine towers. We have advanced battery plants around Michigan. We have advanced biofuels. I could go all around the state. Mm-hmm. Here in Ann Arbor, there is a core of very exciting new innovation. But here's why we need to do this. Because the future, the next round of the Industrial Revolution is advanced manufacturing and new advanced energy technologies. We cannot afford to have China or Germany on the other end that's trying to outcompete us win those battles so that we go from foreign dependence on oil to foreign dependence on advanced batteries, wind, or solar. And the truth is, we have had a policy picking winners and losers in this country for 100 years. The winner was oil, because they have had a production tax credit. They have had incentives for almost 100 years. So the winner has been oil. The loser has been consumers. What I want is a level playing field where we allow through our tax policy and through partnerships, the ability to create choices so consumers win at the pump.
Okay. You mentioned China, so we're going to go to a question on that from Kathy in Brighton. Kathy?
Yes, good morning.
Your question, please.
Yeah, it seems to me that China is a big issue in this campaign, both in your race, Senator, and in the presidential. But is there really anything that can be done about China taking our jobs?
Absolutely. Thank you, Kathy, for that question. You know, we're in a global economy. We need to export. We are exporting. I sit on the President's Export Council. I was appointed by both President Bush and President Obama. But the bottom line is, we want to export our products, not our jobs. And so here's how we do that. We've got to make sure everybody's following the same rules. I've been pushing for years to set up a trade enforcement unit that just focuses on making sure other countries don't steal our patents, don't counterfeit our products, are following the rules. And I'm very pleased that after pushing this for years, President Obama has established that new trade unit. He's taken a very aggressive position right now, a new trade case against auto supply parts with China. We won a tires case against China that was dumping faulty Chinese tires into the U.S., and it would have cost us about 1,000 jobs. So bottom line is, we've got to make sure there's a level playing field on trade. That's what we're doing. I have a whole range of things that I've been working on to be able to make that happen, from trade enforcement to currency manipulation. We passed a bill in the Senate, bipartisan.
Well, let's ask about that.
Currency manipulation.
Does Mitt Romney have it right? Is it time to brand China a currency manipulator and go to work on sanctions?
I believe that China is a currency manipulator.
So Mitt Romney is right on that.
I would agree with him on that, and I would agree with the president for his aggressive take on counterfeiting and patent stealing and all of the other things that are going on. And I do think we've got to come together as Americans and understand, in this new global economy, it's important that
But you don't think the president has been aggressive enough?
We've passed a bill in the Senate that would give the president the tools to go after China on currency manipulation. It's stuck in the House. It needs to get passed in the House. But that will give more aggressive tools to the president to be able to do that, and we need to get it done. What I'm very appreciative of is that he is the first president to embrace what Senator Lindsey Graham and I have been promoting for a number of years, which is a separate trade enforcement office so businesses can call and say, this is what's happening to me, and somebody will be there at the other end to take on the case.
Okay. And since we're talking about these national issues, let's go to Dina in DeWitt, who has a question about health care.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you for taking my question this morning, Senator.
Good morning.
I just had a quick question. I contacted your Southeast Michigan office about the Affordable Care Act back when it was still being deliberated, and your staff there had admitted, because it was so lengthy, that neither you nor anyone on your staff had actually taken the time to read the bill. And it seems like now we continue to hear so much new information about the ramifications of Obamacare, and it's actually getting a little confusing about what's really going to happen with Medicare and our own personal health insurance premiums. And I'm just wondering, in hindsight, do you think it would have been a good idea to maybe take a little bit more time to analyze the bill and the ramifications of it so that we really could have known what was in the bill before it actually passed?
Well, first, let me indicate, I appreciate the question, but I find it very hard to believe anyone in my staff would have said that, because I'm on the Finance Committee and not only read every page, but helped to put in place the new initiatives that are bringing down Medicare costs for seniors. You know, we have now, this last year, about 120,000 seniors in Michigan that had an average $600 more back in their pocket to pay for their medicine because of the efforts to close the gap in coverage. We have young people on their parents' insurance till age 26, and I've had the opportunity to be with parents. One young couple that asked me to come down to Children's Hospital where their daughter was getting a surgery at 18 months that she wouldn't have been able to get if they didn't have insurance and if pre-existing conditions had been eliminated so that they weren't banned from getting their child a surgery. I had a chance to see her, Corey. She's now 3 years old. I saw her a couple of weeks ago. She looks like she's doing really, really well, even though she has a chronic disease. There are stories after stories where making sure that folks who pay premiums and care about their families can actually get the care that they need and deserve. And going forward, there are very important efforts that will take place to bring down costs for small businesses, because we can pool small businesses together and give them the clout of a big business to be able to get a discount to lower their prices. But, Rick, if I could, because I think in this question was about Medicare, and I want to just take a second, if I might, because there are very different approaches on Medicare. What was done in the Affordable Care Act to save dollars, because we know that good news is that Medicare is working. We're living longer. My 86-year-old mom can play with her three great-grandchildren, my grandchildren, who are the most beautiful kids in the world. But it means that we have to create some savings. And to do that, we went after overpayments to insurance companies. So we created hundreds of billions of savings by focusing both on prevention, making sure seniors can get a wellness visit without out-of-pocket costs every year, and cutting overpayments to for-profit insurance companies that through Medicare Advantage. What did we do with that? Well, we put it back into helping folks pay for medicine, and we lengthened the Medicare Trust Fund by 8 years. Then, on the other side, has been the proposal supported by my opponent, supported by Mitt Romney and others, two versions of it, but they both do the same thing, which is create a voucher, add $6,400 for seniors and per okay. year in the future, and all
I'm gonna
that
have
money,
to, I'm
just
going to
close
to,
and say, I'm all that money to goes to you. A tax
Welcome back. I am Rick Pluta with Senator Debbie Stabenow, taking your calls and questions. The number is 866-255-2762. You can also send us a message on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling, or email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. And so we were talking about Medicare when we went to that break, and we're going to continue on that with Mary from Royal Oak. Mary, thanks for your call.
Good morning. I'm a senior, and I'm concerned with all the talk of the changes that are going to be proposed to be made to Medicare, and so I would like to ask the senator if she supports any of the cuts to our senior benefits.
Well, thank you very much for the question. And, Rick, I know we had to go to break last time, so I appreciate to be able to come back and talk more about this, because I care so deeply about it. I do not support cutting benefits to seniors or cutting the opportunity for Medicare for the future for those under age 55, my children, grandchildren, folks in
Michigan. Because these benefit cuts are prospective.
They are prospective. And that's, and I think it's interesting to me that politically, you know, my opponent and others on the other side are saying to folks on Medicare, well, don't worry, it doesn't affect you, although it will affect anyone in Michigan under 55. It will affect our children, our grandchildren. A lot of folks in Michigan had to retire not of their own free will at 50, 52, and so on, will be hit, will be slammed by this. And so here are the differences. One is an approach to save dollars and put it back into Medicare. That's what I support. Put it back into Medicare. And in fact, by cutting overpayments, we've seen Medicare premiums come down 7% last year, and more people are enrolling, even though the opponents said it'd be the exact opposite. Just, it's not happening. Premiums are coming down. So here's the other side. The other side says we can't afford Medicare anymore. And there's two versions. One passed last year, the Ryan budget. It completely changed Medicare, makes it into a voucher. And my opponent said at the time he supported that. Then because AARP and all the other senior groups came out so strongly opposed to it, they came back and said, okay, we'll make it a choice, a voucher or traditional Medicare. But they've done it in a way it ends up in the same spot, which is prices going up. And we're told in the future, $6,400 on average to start. And to add insult to injury, the part that just really drives me crazy is that they take the money. They don't put it back into Medicare. They do another tax cut for people earning over $1 million a year that averages about $250,000 a person. That's according to the budget office. So as far as I'm concerned, there is no way I would support that. Social Security and Medicare are great American success stories. Folks have paid in their whole life. I'll be willing to make tough decisions to make sure it's there for the future. But frankly, middle-class families and seniors have paid enough in the last 10 years, sacrificed enough in the last 10 years. We ought to be making sure that those at the top are helping to pay down this debt as much as anybody else.
Okay, we're going to go and talk about the manufacturing economy because we're seeing a rebound. It's really, you know, we've seen a jobs gain over the past year. A lot of that has been in manufacturing, but it's been anemic. Our unemployment rate here is still higher than the national average. We were the only state to lose population over the last decade. So we want to talk about manufacturing and... I thought we had a manufacturing call. give it to us. What is your path to? We have a question from Nick.
Hi, my name is Nick. I'm from Rochester Hills, Michigan.
Hi, Nick.
And I'd like to ask both the candidates what they do to make higher education more affordable.
Well, this is a very important part, and I do want to talk, Rick, also about manufacturing, but a critical piece of that is higher education and access to the skilled workforce that we need for this new economy in advanced manufacturing. I'm a product of loans and grants going to school and at Michigan State, and the big game's tomorrow, by the way, so as we all know. It's very important that we make higher education more affordable, and we've begun to do some things to do that. There's more to do. First of all, there used to be two ways that we provided student loans, one to subsidize the banks, the other direct student loans. We found that we could save about $8 billion a year if we stopped the subsidies from banks and went all to direct student loans, which is what we're now doing. We then took the $8 billion, put it back into Pell Grants, and we've got over 300,000 people in Michigan, traditional students, those going back to school, who are now getting help with Pell Grants. We've also kept the interest rate down. There was a big fight in July to raise the interest rate again, and I helped lead the effort to keep the interest rate down. And we are looking at parts of certain professions and so on where there's loan forgiveness and other opportunities. But we certainly need to do more.
But then why are students when we went out and started asking people what they wanted to talk about, we heard about this on Facebook and Twitter when we went out and interviewed people that students say they're graduating with this crushing debt. Why are they still saying
that? They are, because unfortunately what's happening is we are seeing cuts at the state level that I'm very concerned about overall when we look at sort of the investments coming down over the years. And I think that's something that we all need to be engaged in.
Okay, so you don't like the state cuts, but as a U.S. senator, what can you do to help
sure.
out there?
Sure. Well, there are two things, because we don't directly fund universities, but there are two areas. One is student financial aid. We have brought down interest rates. We've created more opportunities to cap how much a student has to pay per month and loan forgiveness. We've increased Pell Grants. But the other one that's very important, and to all of our universities, and we're here today in Ann Arbor with a great university of Michigan, is research.
And we have MSU, and we have Wayne State.
Yes.
We have Northern Michigan.
Michigan Tech. I mean, we have our Western. I mean, I could go all around the state. Great universities. And, of course, my alma mater, Michigan State, I have to get in there. But the fact is that the federal government partners on research dollars that then turn into opportunities for students, grad students, other opportunities for jobs and efforts on campus. So the piece that the federal government does is partnering on research, everything from advanced manufacturing, clean energy, health research, medical technologies, everything you can imagine, agricultural research, and then help with student financial aid.
Okay, just what's the one big thing that you would that you're going to push for in the U.S. Senate to do something about the debt burden for graduating college students?
I believe that both the state and federal governments need to be providing more help for financial assistance. You know, growing up in Clare, a little town of Clare. My folks didn't have a lot of money. My dad got sick when I was in high school. If I had not had a tuition fee scholarship, I wouldn't have been able to go to college. I want to make sure that those opportunities are available for every young person, every person going back to get skill training. And we've got to decide as a state and a country that we are going to embrace that if we're going to win in a global economy. It is about out-educating and out-innovating, and that goes right back to what we're doing in community colleges and universities.
Is post-secondary education necessary for everyone?
I think it is necessary, but it takes on a lot of different looks. Right now in Michigan, Henry Ford Community College is leading a multi-state effort. We have several community colleges that are getting funding. There's a $15 million investment on advanced manufacturing training. And it's Michigan's leading it, of course, but it's being done for a number of different states. And it's very specifically looking at how we match up the new needs of businesses, because I hear all the time now, folks who want to hire can't find the skills they need. But we have a lot of skilled people, a lot of smart people. So how do we match that up? So the new skills involved a whole range of skilled trades. Up in Saginaw, we see Dow Corning partnering with Delta College. I was up there meeting with them on a new fast track, fast start, I think it's called. It's only, I think it's 7 weeks, something like that, and you go, you know, almost every day, and you come out, and you've got a great job in solar technology. We're seeing that whether it's Lansing Community College, whether it's wind technology over at Kalamazoo Community College. I mean, I can go all around Michigan, and there are partnerships going on, and I think that is a very important part of our future. We've got to make sure we are training and providing opportunities for great jobs, great skilled jobs with the employers who need the skilled workforce.
Okay, but you don't think that a 7-week course is going to get someone the sort of job the sort of jobs that we're talking about?
I absolutely think, actually, Rick, that there are very specific skilled trades jobs that pay good middle-class salaries, they're great salaries, that are going to be available if we do this kind of training. In fact, there's a whole generation of us as baby boomers. You know, when I went down
to... So you think that someone can graduate from high school, take a summer course, and be ready to hit the workforce?
This summer course may sound, you know, it may not be exactly what I'm saying. I mean, this is a very intense, highly skilled effort. Mott Community College is doing it. Monroe Community College, working with Venn Towers, is focusing on advanced welders, for instance. This is big equipment, big steel. You can't afford an error. These are very well-paid jobs. And what we have are a generation of all of us baby boomers retiring, and these new skills are needed. Good-paying jobs, and we don't have people coming into the pipeline. So to me, it it may be a 7-week, it may be a 2-year, it may be a 4-year, it may be a 6-year. We need all kinds of skills, but we have tremendous opportunities in these new skilled trades for great jobs.
We have a Facebook question from Vanessa in Howell, who wants to know how do you plan to support the Violence Against Women Act?
You know, the Violence Against Women Act over the years has been something very nonpartisan. We normally pass it on a voice vote in the Senate, in the House. It funds not only domestic violence shelters, but it also provides help for law enforcement, because domestic violence situations are traditionally the most dangerous situation our police officers walk into. So traditionally, this is done in a nonpartisan basis. Unfortunately, as part of everything else that's happened as it relates to women and healthcare and equal pay and domestic violence, it's gotten held up now, and people are getting very partisan about it. The House will not pass this bill, and I can...
Because it's gotten caught up in the controversies abortion coverage and contraception?
No, it just in general, it's now viewed as controversial to support all victims of domestic violence, which is stunning to me. And I can tell you, talking to police officers, and I'm very, very, very proud to have the endorsement and support of the police officer organizations in Michigan, representing the majority of officers from the UP down to southern Michigan. In talking to them, this is critical. This is, as they have seen cutbacks at the state level again, to have these dollars come in for police officers is very important. So, I was very proud as a county commissioner back in the 70s to put together the first domestic violence shelter in mid-Michigan. It was Washtenaw and Ingham County did the first two shelters. We've come a long way. This is not controversial. This is about protecting those who are victims of domestic violence. And unfortunately, it has become partisan in the House, and I can't answer why. It's stunning to me.
Let's take a question from Bob. Bob, thanks for waiting.
Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
How does your campaign comply with our local, state, or national anti-bullying programs?
How does my campaign? I mean, I certainly...
Bob, are you asking for her position?
Well, no. I'm just commenting on how I see our politicians going at each other, and it reminds me of some bullying.
Interesting point, Bob.
Interesting.
Okay.
Very interesting. I was going to say, because I've worked with our schools in supporting efforts, to be able to stop what can be absolutely devastating to a student.
But Bob's question is about the demeanor of campaigning.
You know, I don't blame you from being upset when there is so much negative going on. In this campaign, as you've probably noticed, I've run ads with folks around Michigan that are talking about what I have done, from a manufacturer talking about my efforts to fight on their behalf against counterfeiting in China to farmers.
But, Senator, the Michigan Truth Squad actually called foul on one of your ads for what you said about your opponent.
Well, the good news is that they said overwhelmingly what we have said in quoting Pete in his own words, because we've basically put
up videos. It said a lot of it was true, but it did call foul.
In Medicare, they're saying that the latest version of Medicare
Ryan plan is different, and that
version.
You went and cherry-picked an earlier position in order to make your opponent look worse than his position actually was.
My opponent's on record supporting the original voucher plan, and then when AARP and all the senior groups came out adamantly opposed it, they changed it a bit, so it's still a voucher plan. I would argue that he's on record supporting the most extreme plan that passed the House of Representatives, and the second plan isn't much better because it still has vouchers to pay for tax cuts for multimillionaires. But here's what I would say. I think it's important in elections for all of us as voters to make it clear that those that the extreme horrible ads don't work, and that we go. One of the great things about the internet today, about being able to fact check on our own, is we can find out what the truth is and make our own decisions. And I think that creates a kind of power for voters that is very, very important. And as I said, when I look at all of the ads that we've done, and interestingly, I have been very fortunate to have both strong support from Democrats and Republicans. And in my ads, we have predominantly Republicans at this point, farmers and business people that are supporting my efforts to make sure we're making things and growing things in Michigan and that we still have a middle class in Michigan.
Okay, Bob, thanks for sparking an interesting discussion. One more question from Facebook before we have to take a short break. This is from Marcia, who asks, as a mother who works outside the home at a stressful job, how can we make childcare more affordable or encourage more flex time jobs? What can the government do about that in a minute and a half, Senator?
Well, boy, I have to say that one hits home for me as a mom. It hits home for me now as my daughter, who just had her first little baby who's 3 months old. And, you know, I could go on and on about how beautiful he is. But she's struggling with that right now as well. I think, first of all, we have to make sure that we keep in place in any tax reform the child care credit, the child credit for families. You know, there's a lot of talk about closing loopholes and making changes, and I want to make sure that those things that help families, child care, the marriage penalty deduction, and so on, all stay in effect. I think that family and medical leave, allowing families to be able to step away after having a baby,
she would like to know
what
more you could do.
Well, I think that strengthening what we're doing around the child tax credit, around the support for families to have more flexibility in the workplace to support employers. I would welcome your ideas on what you think would work the best, whether that's increased efforts through the tax code or to support local child care efforts. At minimum, we should not be rolling things back, which is one of the big debates that we've been involved in. I'm on the side of making sure we don't hit families and children again. But I think tax credits, I think more services are
available. What's the biggest threat when you talk about rolling them back? What is the biggest threat to that?
I think there has been an effort to say that somehow the child tax credit or the child care credit somehow are loopholes that should be eliminated or cut back. And I think that's ridiculous. Any mom and dad trying to take care of their children would say we ought to start by making sure those are there.
Okay. Well, thanks, Senator. A short break here. You are listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Debbie Stabenow on the Michigan Public Radio Network. And welcome back to Michigan Calling. I'm Rick Pluta here with Senator Debbie Stabenow, and we are talking in this last part of our show about the environment and about agriculture. And you, Senator Stabenow, are chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee. The phone number to call is 866-255-2762. You can message us on Facebook or Twitter at Michigan Calling, or you can email us at michigancalling@gmail.com. And our first question right now.
My name is Martha Lapine. I am from the Long Lake area in Grand Traverse County. And my question for you, Debbie, is what happened to the Farm Bill?
It stalled.
Great question. And first of all, as you know, coming from Grand Traverse, our tart cherries growers have been hit harder than anybody, sweet cherries as well, harder than anybody in the state. And I work very, very closely with our growers. We worked together very, very closely on a bipartisan basis starting last year to come up with a deficit reduction plan to start with before doing the Farm Bill that was bipartisan House Senate. And we were the only committee within the deficit reduction process to actually come up with a bipartisan proposal for cuts, $23 billion in cuts to reduce the deficit. That deficit reduction plan didn't end up happening, which is a great concern to me. But we decided to go ahead and put in place the cuts that we were proposing and working with the House and the Senate together. And everybody said, you'll never get this done. It's the worst partisan environment ever in the world. And we decided we were going to put our heads down, just work hard, and do it. So in the Senate, we passed a bipartisan bill.
And
worked with House colleagues, yes.
Can we give Jane a chance to just ask you a question about that?
Sure.
Okay. Jane, your question for Senator Stabenow on the Farm Bill.
I hear a lot about what you're doing on the Farm Bill. Can you tell me more about it and why it makes a difference for people who aren't farmers?
Absolutely.
Right. So you're talking process. Let's talk importance.
What's in it. Yes, yes. Well, I was talking process just to get us to sort of where we are now, that which is just simply we passed a bipartisan bill in the Senate, the House committee did, and then the House Speaker would not take it up, which is stunning to me. And we've the policy technically.
And I want to talk more about that in a minute.
So, let's talk about it. Particularly if we ate today, I'm sitting here eating some grapes. If we are eating today, think a farmer, because the reality is that as consumers, we still have the safest, most affordable food supply in the world because of a small group of folks that take big risks with the weather and everything else. So here's what our Farm Bill does. First of all, we save money by cutting out four subsidies that don't make sense anymore. Because right now, we pay farmers for things they don't even grow. Makes no sense. We, in turn, say that crop insurance ought to be there. So if you have a risk like what happened to cherry growers, they ought to have crop insurance, which they don't have today.
And so we're you're make transferring sure the subsidy to an insurance program.
Absolutely. Which means we go from subsidies that happen no matter whether you have good times or bad to crop insurance that deals with risk. And so that saves $15 billion by doing that. The other thing that we do is transfer more towards local food systems, farmers markets, which are growing all the time in Michigan. The ability to purchase local schools be able to purchase from Michigan growers, which is new, something I've done as chair of the Ag Committee that wasn't available before. So we've saved money, but we've also moved more towards local food systems and supporting family farmers and local growers. The other thing that's very exciting for us, the major way we protect land and water in this country on lands that's owned by somebody is through the Farm Bill. And it's conservation programs, working with farmers on voluntary efforts. And we've created a whole new area called regional partnerships, and the Great Lakes are one of those regional partnerships, to fund efforts to protect our water quality, runoff, pesticides into the water, erosion. So that's a big piece of it. Then the other thing that we have done is really strengthen the energy jobs part of what we do. And this is what I talked about back at the beginning of the program, advanced biofuels and bio-based manufacturing. And giving an example, up in Fremont right now, the USDA is helping to provide a loan guarantee for a company called Novi Energy that's using Gerber baby food waste to put into a biodigester, and enzymes are creating energy, and they're now selling it to the grid starting this week, and they're going to be able to provide electricity for 1,500 homes from food waste, and they're beginning to look at areas around the state to do it. So this is a real area for job growth, mm-hmm. and it's going to help us get off of foreign oil.
Can I ask you this is a food safety question from Sharon in Newberry, who is a vegetarian, and she says, this came to us on Facebook, millions of U.S. citizens are opposed to genetically modified organisms in the food supply and being released into the environment. There is no proof that this is safe. This is what Sharon says. At a minimum, won't you support labeling of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, through your work chairing the Ag Committee?
Well, this goes through the Health Committee and the FDA. It's an important question, and the FDA needs to make sure that they are testing and determining what is safe and not safe. And we absolutely ought to be labeling when we know it is not safe, because GMOs are a very, very broad category. I mean, we do a lot of things that would be viewed as hybrids to improve yield and have use less water and less pesticides, which are very important for the environment, but that are
but
also
farmers
safe.
Aren't always happy with that level of regulation.
Well, no, this is about whether or not we use new science, just like you would do for hybrids on rose bushes or something. We are improving science so that the corn seed uses less water, less pesticides, which is better for the environment. But we've got to make sure that it's safe for humans, obviously. And so those tests are being done. If there is a question about safety, that ought to be labeled. Okay.
Well, while we're talking about the environment, let's go to a call from Richard. Richard, your question for Senator Stabenow.
Rick, I'd like to ask Senator Stabenow why there has been so little discussion in the Congress or in the White House about global warming.
Well, we have certainly been discussing what is happening on the climate and the changes relating to the climate, and we're seeing it. Certainly, our farmers are on the front end of that. I mean, we had the hottest July ever, and we're seeing huge droughts as well as warming up last March and then freezing again in April, which wiped out so much of our fruit crop. And so there is a lot of work looking at what exactly that is all about and how we can address it. The good news is there are a number of things that farmers are doing, creating biodigesters, doing a better job on conservation, no-till efforts and so on, working in a voluntary way on innovation and on conservation, which are very, very important. And frankly, there are other areas that are creating jobs for us that have the benefit of also getting us off of foreign oil and addressing climate concerns, like the new efforts around advanced batteries and wind and solar and geothermal. And I'm an all-of-the-above person. I think on energy we ought to do all of it. I just want it to be American and create American jobs. And the good news is it also then affects us as it relates to the changes in climate.
That is Senator Debbie Stabenow taking your questions here on the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm Rick Pluta. We're taking your calls and questions. And the next question is from Melanie in Westland. Melanie, your question for the senator, please.
Yes, my name is Melanie Hines. I'm from Westland. And my question is, with taxes being a big issue for the middle class, all I hear about on the campaign trail is a lot of he said, she said. What is the difference between you and your opponent on taxes?
Well, thank you very much for that question. I think this is one of the central questions about how we view America and what our values are. The difference on this campaign is that I am very, very focused on making sure middle-class families and seniors don't get hit again with any tax increases or other kinds of burdens like they've had in the last 10 years. I think everybody ought to be paying their fair share. I think it's fair to say my opponent believes that if you give all of the tax breaks to multimillionaires, to special interests at the top, that it will someday trickle down. I don't know about you. I'm tired of waiting for it to trickle down. It just didn't work during the Bush years. That theory just didn't work. That trickle-down theory coupled with deregulation on Wall Street cost us home values, 8 million jobs, and a whole lot of pension value and 401k
value.
But
to be clear, you believe that people with higher incomes should pay a bigger share of that income in taxes than people in lower incomes. Not just bigger dollar amounts, but a bigger percentage of their income.
I believe that after giving tax cuts predominantly in 2001 and 2003 to multimillionaires, which didn't create jobs during those years, but it created huge, huge debts. We didn't pay for the wars that we went into. Nothing was paid for during that time. By the way, I opposed the efforts that went on during that time that were not paid for. But we saw, in fact, a huge deficit. I believe if we went back simply to the Clinton years, the tax rates of the Clinton years, where we balanced the budget for the first time in 30 years. I was there in 1997 when we did that, balanced the budget and created 22 million jobs. To me, that's common sense. To me, it's not about ideology. I just want to know what works. You know, for me, it's very personal. I've lived in Michigan my whole life. My whole family's here. I just want things that work. And what didn't work was giving more tax breaks to multimillionaires, socking it to the middle class and seniors, creating a big deficit and losing jobs.
You say you want things that work, but everything that you've just laid out, you have steadfast opposition from the other party on. How do you bridge that?
Well, first of all, we maybe have to have less of the other party casting the votes. That might help us if we had a bigger majority. But I think what's got to happen is in the election, folks have got to just reject overall this trickle-down economics and say, look, we got to we got to tackle the debt. We got to balance the budget. We got to sit down and do it in a way that's fair for everybody, not just, you know, asking the middle class to pay more or seniors to pay more and get less on their Medicare. Let's make sure everybody's chipping in. It's not about punishing anybody. It's about everybody chipping in. And then we got to out-educate and out-innovate in a global economy. And so that's what we've done in the past when it worked. And we started down 4 years ago. 2009, 2010, we started down that road with new innovations, tax cut that I authored, 30% tax cut that has created jobs here on clean energy. We started down that road with a retooling loan program I authored that Ford's using at the Wayne plant, retooled their operations for new vehicles. They're bringing jobs back from Mexico. But then we got stalled after that over a whole bunch of partisan politics in the last 2 years that has stalled an effort that began to turn us. And so I think we got to keep moving forward on a path that's begun to work. Long way to go, but it's begun to work.
Yeah, here's another bipartisan. Here is something where there is bipartisan agreement, at least in Michigan. In Michigan. But this is a message from Steve in White Cloud who wants to know about Asian carp. Why isn't the Army Corps of Engineers moving more quickly to stop the Asian carp invasion? What are you doing to move this process along? I know that you've worked with Congressman Dave Camp from Northern Michigan, a Republican, but you haven't gotten what you want on that, at least not yet.
Right. We're making progress, but you're absolutely right. We are not there yet. This is something that Dave Camp and I have worked on. And frankly, the whole delegation, one of the things that I'm very proud of is we all come together to fight for Michigan around the Great Lakes. And this is very, very important. We have put in place some rigid timelines through the Army Corps to give us specific engineering recommendations so that we can deal with what's happening. By the way, the Army Corps has come back and said they can't meet the deadlines, and that is not acceptable. And so Congressman Camp and I are pushing back. We're going to go back and put ultimate pressure on them to do that. Here's what has happened.
What is that deadline?
It was 90 days to give us preliminary recommendations.
By when?
And which they already missed. I mean, they came out and said, basically, here's some preliminary recommendations, but we can't meet the deadline of the end of next year. And we said, that's not good enough. Here's what has happened, though, that's important. By all of us coming together and all the Great Lakes governors, we now have determined exactly what it's going to take to be able to do what's called a hydrological separation. I shouldn't say exactly what it takes. We know what it's going to take. We need the Army Corps to tell us, you know, how to separate the waters coming up from Illinois River, Mississippi, into Lake Michigan. But here's the other thing.
Which is a multi-billion dollar project.
It is, although it is achievable and doable. And when it's much, much less than losing a $7 billion fishing industry and a $16 billion boating recreational industry in Michigan.
But has your president with the hometown of Chicago left you hanging on that particular issue?
They have stood with us as we have financed the largest effort to protect the Great Lakes ever. Do I wish the locks were closed? Yes, I do. And Dave and I have pushed on that, which the city of Chicago has fought vehemently because of commerce issues and flooding issues and so on. But we are putting in the major effort necessary to monitor what's happening now and figure out what to do. We've got to get the Army Corps to act, though. But here's what we have found out, which is very significant. And it's unfortunately what keeps me up at night in terms of these fish. It's not just Illinois anymore. We've found 17 different points where they could go into the Great Lakes. They're going across the river in Indiana. The monitoring we've been doing and the all-hands-on-deck approach has actually found that the Indiana DNR has put up a temporary barrier to stop from going from the Wabash River into the Maumee River and into Lake Erie. But we're also now seeing this fish DNA in Lake Erie, which is very troubling because it's shallower and much more conducive to the fish. So we're now addressing that. So the good news is that the all-hands-on-deck approach with all the states and the federal government and all of us working together has mapped out the problem. The bad news is it's a bigger problem than we thought.
And you don't have a solution yet. Quickly, just Aaron from Midland asks you, what can you do about gay marriage?
Well, I think
I'm not sure whether she's a supporter or not.
I mean, I respect religious differences, certainly in terms of churches deciding what kinds of ceremonies they perform that needs to be determined by the church. I also think from a civil standpoint that all committed couples should have the opportunity for civil protections. And so, and I think this right now is being litigated in the courts.
Okay. Just very, very quickly, you talked about bipartisanship. There's also bicameral ship.
Right.
You've got to get your farm bill through the House of Representatives. When's the last time you talked to your counterpart in the
Frequently. I mean, one of the things, Chairman Lucas and I really gained a friendship and a great working relationship when we did deficit reduction last year. In fact, it was one of the byproducts, even though the big deficit reduction plan didn't get passed. He has known every step of the way of what we were doing, what was in our bill, what was the same, what was different.
So then why is it stalled?
Because whatever reason, the most extreme elements in the House, led by the Tea Party, which, by the way, my opponent worked with Michelle Bachmann and has proudly indicated that he helped form the Tea Party caucus. But these folks don't think we ought to support agriculture, conservation, nutrition, anything. And so they're holding it up.
So what do you do to reach out to that group to get your legislation and the other things? You know, we've got sequestration coming up, big cuts, the fiscal cliff.
Right.
If you can't find a way to accomplish not just bipartisanship, but bicameralship.
Well, here's what we are focused on, because I'm laser focused going back, and I've met with all the agricultural groups. We've done rallies. They're not usually the folks doing rallies in Washington. They came in September, and they're going to be coming back in November. This is truly bipartisan across the country to work with the chairman and the ranking members. So we have Democrats and Republicans on the committee in the House. I think when folks get off the trail coming back into the House, they're going to want to get this done, because they're hearing from their constituents all across the country that it's irresponsible they didn't get it done.
And that has to be the final word. Our thanks to Senator Debbie Stabenow for her time, and also to all of you for your questions. Be sure to tune in next Friday when we do our special call-in with Republican challenger Pete Hoekstra. Michigan Calling was produced and directed by the amazing Zoe Clark, engineered by the great Bob Scon. We had help from Jake Neer, Allie Billings, and Melissa Benmark. Thank you to Michigan Radio for hosting us for this program. This has been a special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network.